Thanks for downloading the talk show from KERA 90.1 Dallas-Fort Worth. You can learn more and support this program at KERA.org.
This is the talk show on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Kicking off our planned series of interviews with the candidates for governor of Texas, my guest today is 46-year-old Chris Bell. He's a Democrat who grew up and went to public school in the Park Cities, then graduated from UT and later South Texas College of Law. Bell worked as a broadcast journalist in Oklahoma, Amarillo, and Houston before getting his law degree. He also served on the Houston City Council and in the U.S. Congress. His most famous political crusade to date may be the one he launched against Tom DeLay's 2003 redistricting plan that effectively knocked Bell out of Congress by situating him in a heavily minority district. Chris Bell is the first candidate for governor this year to accept the talk show's invitation to spend the hour being interviewed and responding directly to your comments and questions. We'll have time for that in just a couple of minutes. Chris, welcome to the talk show.
Thanks a lot, Chris.
You have said that your goal is to move Texas out of the Thank God for Mississippi Club. Are we really that bad off?
Yes. When you look at where we find ourselves in so many different categories, whether you're talking about the dropout rate, the number of kids growing up without health care insurance, the overall number of uninsured teen pregnancy, the number of people in prison, in category after category, we're in just about the worst position now. And it's alarming. And I first arrived at that and realized that after reading one too many stories talking about Texas being in last place in this category or that category, and I asked my congressional staff to actually look into it because I was a little bit curious as to if that could really be true. This is Texas, after all. And I thought I'd get a one-page memo back, and it came back, and it went on for four pages. And health care and education, category after category, there we were with terrible rankings when measured against other states. And the light bulb kind of went off. I said, you know, this isn't the state I had the privilege of growing up in.
Is that just due to bad management of Texas, or do you still believe that we've got some issues and some problems here based on our geographic location that other states don't have to contend with?
It's funny that you should say that, because Rick Perry was asked why we find ourselves in last place when he was kicking off his campaign for governor. A reporter told me this later. And his response to why we're in last place in so many categories was, it's because we're a border state. And while I think that does demonstrate an amazing grasp of geography on the part of the governor, it's also rather appalling because, yes, we do face some unique challenges as a result of our proximity to Mexico and our immigrant population. But it seems to me we can either step up and start addressing some of those challenges and designing policies to give people the tools that they need to lift themselves up and get ahead in life, or we can keep just falling further and further behind.
You've referred to budgets as moral documents. Can you explain that?
Well, I actually stole it from God's Politics. Jim Wallace writes about it, and I think it's brilliant in that if it changes the mindset of how you look at government and how you look at budgeting for a state government. If you see them as moral documents and recognize that they're human costs associated with the fiscal decisions that are being made. And that's what oftentimes in recent years has been overlooked in Austin. You make it all about scrubbing the budget, and that's all well and good. And while I was on the Houston City Council and in Congress, I was always looking for more efficient ways that we could do things, and that's very important. But when it becomes all about scrubbing the budget and you forget about the human costs, then you pay a very significant price. And after the 2003 legislative session and all of the cutbacks that were made, you watch Governor Perry run around the state and scream about the fact that they had balanced the budget without any type of tax increase. Well, then we watch as over 150,000 kids lost their health care insurance and 500 kids lost their lives as a result of abuse and neglect, kids that were supposed to be guarded by Child Protective Services. And those are the types of human costs that I'm talking about, and the reason that I really do think you have to look at budgets as moral documents and get serious about making sure that your state budget is morally balanced as well.
Recognizing both the financial costs and the human costs, do you think that with limited dollars for, let's take public health care for an example,
okay,
is it ever appropriate to use immigration status as the cutoff if there's not enough to go around?
Well, that's always a tough question, and I think that's going to be a part of this immigration reform debate going forward. But when you look at what's happening with immigration, and obviously it's an issue that comes up every place that I go, I and everyone talks about reform, but I think we're also going to have to look at some of the laws that are presently on the books. And currently, employers are not supposed to hire undocumented workers. Well, you know and I know that they do. And this whole debate is a little bit disingenuous when you've allowed reporters to put up signs, figuratively, that say apply here. And you have people living in impoverished conditions in Mexico, and they choose to come here to apply for those jobs and take those jobs, and oftentimes in miserable conditions, and allow themselves to be mistreated because they are undocumented. And then we look around and say, what are you doing here? And I think we need to be honest about it, and that seems to be part of this debate about immigration that's always overlooked, the laws that are presently on the books. And I think we should step up and start enforcing them, and we might not even be having this debate about immigration. There are things that we need to do to restore order on the border, and if we do, I don't think we have to talk about cutoffs and other things like that.
Your website says, and I want to make sure I get the quote right, Jesus never said, heal the sick unless politics gets in the way. Talk about that a little bit and how your faith plays into what you want to do in Texas.
Well, he also didn't consult the Pharisees before he healed the lepers. And I believe very strongly that God gives us the gifts of science and technology that we should take advantage of to help our fellow man. And we're simply not doing that. And that comment is in reference to stem cell research and something I feel very strongly about. After losing my mom and 1999, after she had fought a 10-year battle with Parkinson's disease, and watching my wife Allison last year having to fight a successful battle with breast cancer, you watch the people you have loved the most in your life fight those kinds of battles, and there's nothing you wouldn't do to keep other families from having to go through the same. And stem cell research offers the greatest hope to folks, whether they're suffering from Parkinson's or Alzheimer's or cancer or spinal cord injury, a whole host of very cruel diseases. And Rick Perry says that he will do everything that he possibly can to keep any taxpayer dollars from going to fund stem cell research. And I just don't think he could be any more wrong. And he's the one who wants to bring it in the debate about abortion politics where it doesn't belong in any way, shape, or form. And he says he wants to make it a moral argument. Well, let's make it an argument about morals. And I do think that the moral side of this is helping your fellow man and adding to their quality of life while here on Earth. And because of our research institutions and our colleges and universities and medical centers, we are perfectly positioned to be a leader in the area of stem cell research. But meanwhile, philanthropic dollars flock to other states like California that have gotten serious about moving the research forward, and it's time that we get serious about it here in Texas.
It's nothing new in this country in politics for leaders to base the way they make their decisions on their personal beliefs, very often religious beliefs. It definitely seems that in the past couple of decades, there has been a great deal more open discussion of this. Do you worry at all that religion, and in particular Christianity, has become a political tool in this country that is not always used sincerely?
Well, it's a very fair question, and I was very uncomfortable with it for a long time, but have come to feel that My faith is personal, but it's not necessarily private. And there are a lot of other things I have to share about myself in the course of a campaign that most people don't in other professions. But I think regardless of what someone's faith is, they're curious as to whether that's important in somebody's life. Maybe it's not in some candidates' lives. It does happen to be important in mine, and so I don't mind sharing that. I think the dividing line comes if someone is trying to jam their faith down somebody's throat. And I don't try to do that, but I do use it from time to time to support why I've taken a certain position. And I guess where it really hit home with me, and I think a big mistake the Democratic Party made some 25 years ago was forfeiting this debate to the Republican Party and saying we weren't going to be involved in the debate about morals and values in this country. And then allowed the Republican Party to paint Democrats as being somewhat amoral and giving an impression to a lot of young people in this country that some of the people in the Democratic Party, folks that have the greatest moral values that I've ever seen, allowed them to be painted in this amoral fashion and when nothing could be further from the truth. And what really hit me was a couple years ago, really before this entire debate broke out, it was 2004, and I'd been asked to speak at my old Episcopal church that was doing a series on politics and faith. And it came time for questions and answers, and a friend of mine raised his hand, a gentleman who actually was Republican but had supported me for city council, and raised his hand and said, Chris, what I want to know is Jesus had the most radical social agenda of anyone to ever walk the face of the earth, but you all in the Democratic Party never invoke that. Why is that? And I stood there silently. Usually I can come up with an answer, but I couldn't. And I thought about it a lot from that day forward and have started talking about it because I do think it's important for people to realize, and the Democratic Party needs to be involved in that debate and in shaping the morals and values agenda here in the United States.
A lot of people are familiar with the ethics action that you took against Tom DeLay, but this has been something of a theme in your career. What was the genesis of that? Was it when you were working on city council, or was it something that you always felt like as an elected leader you would really want to make a focus of what you did?
Well, I sort of had my John McCain moment in serving on the Houston City Council. I got caught up in a scandal that because of a bad judgment involving some flatware that had been given to several council members as a gift, and I was serving as the chair of the ethics committee at the time, and it was investigated and I was exonerated, but I also recognized the need for certain rules to be on the books for more of a guide path. And so I have made ethics a real charge in my public career and something that I've tried to do. I think the bottom line is that you really need to be looking at the quality of individuals you elect to serve in public office. But there can be certain guidelines and certain rules on the books that can be written in such a way. And when you look at our state government right now, the problem is that much of the time the things that people do that really are illegal are not as bad as the things that they do that are legal. And that's why we need ethics reform in our state government. But at city council and serving as the chair of the ethics committee, I looked at what was going on, and we needed campaign finance reform. We needed a lobbyist registration ordinance, something so that people would know who folks were working for when they were down there trying to get things done at city hall. We needed a revolving door ordinance so that people couldn't just immediately leave city hall and cash in on their public service experience. That's something that has always galled me. I think people should choose public service if they want to serve the public, not because they just want to set themselves up to feather their nest immediately after leaving. And so when I went to Congress, and I guess it did continue to a certain degree because of how Tom DeLay decided to conduct himself in getting redistricting passed. And what a lot of people forget about is that that was ongoing for quite some time. And we had actually started our investigation of Tom DeLay in 2003. And there had been several allegations that had come to light through the media, his misuse of his position as majority leader to get the FAA involved and the Department of Homeland Security involved in tracking down the lawmakers who had gone to Ardmore to block the redistricting effort and those types of things. And so the effort had begun, and then we put it on hold for a while, and then I went back after losing my attempt at reelection, and we picked up where we had left off, and the rest is history.
Tom DeLay says it was personal, that you were just mad that this didn't work out for you. Well, you did lose to a Democrat in the primary.
Well, Tom DeLay has said a lot of things that haven't proven to be quite accurate as they played out. And we've seen what has developed. He, claimed that all of the charges were personal and that it was part of a great Democratic conspiracy. There was no conspiracy. I decided that a line needed to be drawn, that I was in a position as a member of Congress because only a member of Congress could file an ethics complaint. But, of course, an unwritten truce had developed in the House of Representatives, whereby no matter how foul the conduct, no one would file an ethics complaint against another member. And when you have a self-policing organization, you have to be willing to police yourselves.
Democratic gubernatorial candidate Chris Bell is my guest. We will be back in just a moment to take your questions and calls and emails. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, and the email address is talkshow@kera.org. This is the talk show on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest today is Democratic gubernatorial candidate Chris Bell in the first of a series of planned interviews one-on-one with the candidates that will allow you to ask your questions and hear them interviewed on a variety of subjects. First email comes in, Chris, from Paul here in Dallas asking about money. Let's get this out on the table because Governor Perry has $10 million sitting in the bank to spend. Carol Keaton Strayhorn has about $8 million. My understanding is you have less than $1 million available to you to spend right now. How are you going to make that last through the end of the election period?
Well, I won't have to. I mean, I'm in the process of raising more money now, and the hope is and what we plan to do is raise enough money to we've never planned to raise as much money as either Carol Strayhorn or Rick Perry, and don't think we have to. I have the Democratic Party infrastructure behind me, and really at the end of the day, there are only two people in a position to compete for the governor's office, the Democratic nominee and the Republican nominee, just because of the size of the state. And you really, without that base of support and that party infrastructure, it's almost impossible. But we do have to raise enough to get our message out, and that's what I'm in the process of doing right now. We raised a significant amount before the June 30th deadline, which was the close of the first fundraising reporting period, and took a lot of that money and went up on television in an effort to get better known around the state. And it appears to have worked and put us in that second-place position that we were all competing for, because whoever's in that second-place position is going to be in the best position to challenge Rick Perry. And I think that's going to be me at the end of the day.
4 years ago, Tony Sanchez spent more than $30 million on the same race with the same opponent.
$70 million.
A lot of it was his own money.
Right.
He did raise significantly more, though, from outside sources than you have so far. He has given money to Carol Keaton Strayhorn. Ben Barnes has given money to Carol Keaton Strayhorn. Would you have more money, more resources, more support if she were not in the race?
Well, I think that's fair to say. There have been folks who have traditionally given to Democratic candidates who decided early on that it might be easier to beat Rick Perry in a Republican primary, and their motivation is more getting rid of Rick Perry than supporting her. And then that campaign went nowhere, and she had no chance to win the Republican primary, so she decided to run as an independent. And I guess if you have $50,000, $100,000, $150,000 invested in someone's campaign, you don't want to jump off the ship. But I think a lot of those folks are now taking a second look and wondering if they've been led down the wrong road. And so hopefully some will come back home, some won't, but without them we'll still be able to raise enough money to get our message out.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number, or you can email talkshow@kera.org. Let's go first to Clark in Fort Worth. Hi, Clark.
Hi, Chris. There's a question on immigration. Let's give the American people a choice where the immigrants come from, Russia, Mexico, Poland, with a high school diploma and advanced educational skills. What's wrong with the suggestion? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
I don't know if I completely understand his question requiring a high school diploma before coming to the United States. Did you follow what he was asking?
I think in terms of requiring that as a condition for immigration to the U.S., if I'm not mistaken.
Well, of course, there are certain requirements that people have to meet if they choose to go through the process legally. What's really caused the ire and among many here in the United States is the fact that so many are coming illegally. That's what we're trying to deal with, and I think that requires shoring up the borders and being reasonable and intelligent in our approach. There are ideas out there that I think will work in increasing fencing in certain areas and creating observation abilities. More Border Patrol agents. I thought the National Guard was a good idea and started talking about that before Rick Perry and George Bush did. Arizona was doing it. It seemed commonsensical to me. So there are things that just make sense, and people who live on the border want to see order restored there. Everybody knows that's part of it. But also, I think, as we talked about earlier, enforcing the laws that we presently have on the books and talking about what we're going to do about the people who are already here. And without we weren't even able to evacuate New Orleans successfully. And so it's sort of ridiculous to talk about deporting millions of people. There's no way that we could successfully do that. And so you really, I think that's why it makes sense when George Bush and others talk about a pathway to citizenship. That needs to be part of this debate.
Let's talk a little more about education. I know that you would like to certainly reduce the emphasis on what you call high-stakes testing. You'd like to pay teachers more. How much more would you like to see them get right off the bat?
$6,000 across the board. They got a $2,000 increase out of the special session, and so we would need $4,000 more to bring them up to the national average. And I've talked about a moonshot for education, having the very best public schools in the entire country within the next 10 years, and that's the commitment I'm willing to make, because based on what I've learned during the course of this campaign, I think we can get there if we're willing to make the financial commitment to public school education. And I think it would be very disingenuous to talk about having the best schools in the country if you're not going to pay teachers at least the national average. And that's what the $6,000 across the board pay raise would do.
I think no teachers and very few parents of kids in public schools would disagree that that teachers are could certainly stand to make more money. If there's 300,000 public school teachers in Texas, that's an additional $1.8 billion
right.
a year. Where we get that?
Well, the good news that came out of the special session is that by expanding the business tax and requiring more businesses to pay their fair share, we could be bringing billions of new dollars into our state government. The problem is that Rick Perry chose to make it completely revenue neutral and make it all about property tax relief. And I support property tax relief, and I think most people do, but it was never etched in stone that there had to be a 50-cent reduction. Could have been a quarter. It could have been 35 cents. Perry had used both of those figures at different points in time. And if he had stuck with those, then we could have recognized a lot of new money for public school education and some of the other challenges that we face. Now we're in a position of having to go back to the drawing board and undo some of what was done and closing loopholes. The bipartisan commission was set up to look at the fact that only one out of every 16 businesses was paying the franchise tax here in Texas. That had to change. There had to be a more equitable and fair way of doing things. And they were able to expand it, but then immediately after they closed those loopholes that were allowing so many businesses not to pay the franchise tax, they created $1.5 billion worth of new loopholes. So I think the first order of business now is going back and closing some of those and bringing some of that money back into our system.
Again, acknowledging that public school teachers clearly not getting rich. What convinces you that a raise will improve their performance in the classroom?
Talking to them, I think that...
Are they not trying hard enough now?
I think it's a matter of keeping. You know, experience goes a long way regardless of what profession you're talking about. Right now, 60% of teachers are leaving the profession within the first 5 years. And the two major complaints you hear are pay and the tax test. And that's one reason I talk about the high-stakes testing is that teachers can't stand it, parents can't stand it, students obviously don't like it, administrators. And we made it all about standardized testing. And some standardized testing and using standardized tests as one measuring stick, that's fine. But we've gotten to this point in time where we act like tests are going to make kids smarter, as if a ruler would make you taller. And it doesn't work that way. And going into classrooms and actually talking to kids and hearing them say, you know, all of our time is spent on the tax test, and hearing principals say, I don't even know if we're teaching kids to think anymore. It seems like we're just pounding information in their head and having them regurgitate it at some later point. And as far as accountability goes, because that's always the pushback, how do you ensure accountability? You know, Chris, I have to ask, what accountability? We have the highest dropout rate in the entire country here in the state of Texas, if we choose to be honest about it. College readiness is down based on every study that I've seen, and we have darn near the worst SAT scores in the entire country. So I just don't know exactly what accountability system folks are trying to protect.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's talk next to Robert in Dallas. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Chris. Do you feel that a candidate that tends to treat issues as complex would be at a disadvantage against an opposition party that tends to deny that complexity and try to present appealingly simple, if maybe erroneously simple, solutions to problems? And how do you engage the imagination of the electorate while trying to acknowledge the shades of gray that characterize so many of these issues?
Well, complexity is tough in today's political climate because people don't spend a whole lot of time sitting down and studying the issues and becoming well-versed in what the issues are and the proposals people are putting on the table. But I'm somewhat encouraged during the course of this campaign because we decided very early on that we would try to put common sense solutions on the table and make the campaign about that, my campaign, about just that. And so far, we're meeting with a lot of success. I don't think you can simplify everything, and we do live in somewhat of a soundbite culture where you find a nice quip or a nice slogan But my hope is a lot of people are waking up to that. You know, No Child Left Behind is a perfect example. It's a great slogan. It became very well known, and a lot of people grabbed onto it. But meanwhile, a lot of children are being left behind, and I think people are waking up to that.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next up, let's talk to John in Fort Worth. Hi, John.
Yeah, I just wanted to throw out a thought here, Mr. Bell, on, you know, Texas is a state of mind, and, you know, I get such shock reactions when I tell people that the first Republican governor in over 100 years was elected in the mid-1980s. You know, and it just seems to me that if not all your advertising budget, but if that was thrown out there because people, honestly, people don't understand the issues. A lot of people don't want to understand the issues. They'll pay $500 a month for electricity, they'll still vote Republican. They'll let their poor people go, their poor children go without medical attention that they once had. They'll still vote Republican. You know, but that thought of Texas used to be Democratic, where all these people moved down here. That's a state of mind that people can relate to. I just wanted to throw that out and see your thoughts on that.
Well, John, let's see if we can get an answer for you. I guess the idea is getting the message out of what it is that you want to do. Do you feel like you have the power to do that?
Well, certainly you do have – you're given the bully pulpit and the veto pen, and you can accomplish a great deal as governor of the state, and you can lead. And it really comes down to what kind of leadership skills you have. And I do agree with him to a certain extent that Texas is a state of mind, and people think big here and they dream bigger, and folks have this attitude that there's nothing we can't do. And I think that's why it's so upsetting to people when they recognize that the Texas that they see in their hearts and in the Texas that we see around us today. And that's why I'm running for governor. Because we have fallen behind, and it is upsetting because it's a great state and people are extraordinarily proud here, and they should be. But let's build it. Let's build a state that we can be proud of again and start leading the way like we were years ago when I had the privilege of growing up here.
John referred to how long it had been that Texas was an overwhelmingly Democratic state. Now, with the shoe on the other foot, it's been 1994 was the last time a Democrat won statewide office. What makes you think that you can break the losing streak and that you are not sort of a sacrifice for a time 4 years or 8 years down the road when the Democratic Party in the state is considerably stronger than it is now?
Well, there's no one knows when pendulums are going to swing in politics, and politics is all about timing. And usually when these very serious swings of the pendulum take place, they come about somewhat unbeknownst to the media or somewhat unbeknownst to those of us who are closest to the process because you just don't see the undercurrent developing. Based on what I've seen during the course of this election, I feel very good about it, not so much from what I see in places that are traditionally Democratic strongholds here in Texas for the party, but places that you wouldn't expect any type of Democratic activity whatsoever. The other day we were in Plano, and y'all were enjoying your eighth straight day of 100-plus degree temperatures. I think it was 108 degrees that day, and I thought, oh, good, we're going in the most Republican area in the entire state on a 108-degree day. There's just going to be a giant crowd. Well, there was a giant crowd. There were over 300 people that showed up on a Saturday afternoon in a sweltering inside hall.
Were they dropping like flies?
They were fanning hard, Chris. They were fanning hard. But you see that, and it wasn't an anomaly. We've seen it in Amarillo. We've seen it in Denton, places that aren't considered, you know, bastions of Democratic politics. And so I have to think, you know, people are fed up, and they're crying out for change.
Let's go next to Elizabeth in Fort Worth. Hi, Elizabeth.
My question, I am a community college student, and I eventually want to go to a four-year university, but I can't afford the tuition. What are your plans on fixing the high cost of college tuition in Texas?
Well, Carol Strayhorn and Rick Perry's idea to deregulate college tuition has been an absolute disaster. And as you travel around, you find that tuition at state colleges and universities has gone up usually somewhere between 30 and 150% at every institution here in our state. And at a time when more and more jobs are requiring a college degree, not just here in Texas, but all across the United States, it makes absolutely no sense that we would suddenly decide to make a college education unaffordable for middle-class families. Low-income individuals can usually still find financial aid programs, although that's become more challenging. Rich kids get to go wherever they want, and meanwhile, it's usually the middle class that gets hit the hardest because either the students have to work or the parents just don't have that kind of money. And so we desperately need to put that genie back in the bottle and go back to regulating college tuition, or certainly at the very least capping college tuition, so that we can make it affordable for people here in Texas once again. And that's certainly something I plan to pursue. But you can't have your cake and eat it too. We're going to go back in that category of reassessing our priorities. And I think that higher education should be a priority, and the state should be willing to step up and meet the demand and give colleges and universities the money they need so they won't have to take it out completely out of the hides of students and their parents. Basically, that's a hidden tax in my way of thinking.
Do you think there's a lot of fat left to trim at state universities? That is there spending that really isn't necessary that's contributing to the rise of that tuition?
Well, I'm sure there is, and that's something about the accountability process that you need to look at and make sure the dollars are being spent wisely. But to pretend that we didn't know that this was going to happen, and that's something Carol Strayhorn says, that she just had no idea when she was recommending that we deregulate college tuition that it would go up like this. Well, what did she think was going to happen? That's exactly what everyone knew was going to happen, and that's why it was fought for so long and prevented for so long. And so what everybody knew was going to happen has happened. It's been a somewhat of a disaster because of what's happened to folks like your caller.
1-800-933-5372 is the telephone number if you'd like to speak to Democratic gubernatorial candidate Chris Bell. Next up, we have Steve in Bedford. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Chris. Currently, there are about half as many people in prison in Texas as there are in all of China. And I'm a middle-class, law-abiding Democrat, and I tend to associate with law-abiding, middle-class Democrats and Republicans. And I don't know of a single person who respects the legal system in Texas. A younger member of my family recently got into trouble with the law, and our experience of her progress through the legal system is absolutely disgusting. It's third world. Our entire family was shocked. Not one single person in the entire system, from judge to probation officials to police, spoke to her with any respect or offered her any assistance whatsoever on straightening herself out. And I just wondered if you think that you'll be able to do anything to add a little Christianity to our treatment of transgressors and perhaps actually reduce crime in Texas.
Well, Steve, those are all great questions. We are going to take a quick break, and we will come back in just a minute so that we can give your answer the full attention that it deserves. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to talkshow@kera.org. Back in just a minute with Democratic gubernatorial candidate Chris Bell. Tomorrow on the talk show, Jeff Whittington hosts Anything You Ever Wanted to Know. Send questions and answers anytime to talkshow@kera.org. If you subscribe to our free podcast while you're online, you'll have the option of enjoying this show live every day or whenever it fits into your schedule. Back to today's guest, Democratic gubernatorial candidate Chris Bell. You can join this conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to talkshow@kera.org. Before the break, Chris, we heard from Steve, who was very concerned about the state of the judicial system in Texas. I wanted to know if you had any comments on what he brought up.
Well, there are a lot of concerns in that just less than 10 years ago, we had a prison overcrowding crisis here in the state of Texas, and we were told that if we built new facilities that would deal with that crisis. And now a whole decade hasn't even passed, and they're talking about another prison overcrowding crisis, and county jails are filling up. And you'll hear judges, not just Democratic judges, but Republican judges as well, talking about the need for more options, and especially when it comes to nonviolent offenders and usually those who have been caught possessing drugs. Drug dealers, I think most people agree with me, however long they want to send them to prison, that's just fine. I think they're a big part of the problem. But those who are addicted and could actually get off drugs and lead productive lives, we've done away with most treatment programs in our judicial system, and it's a major concern for me because I don't think we should just be warehousing people. It's extraordinarily expensive, some $17,000 a year. We pay more to keep people in prison than we do to on our public school children, and there's a real disconnect there for me. And so, yeah, if there are treatment programs that are out there that have worked in other states or here in Texas that have been done away with, I think we need to be looking at bringing some of them back and not just tying a judge's hands if he has a nonviolent offender who can get back on the straight and narrow and be a contributing citizen or contribute to our society.
Next on the line, we have Rollin in Fort Worth. Hi, Rollin. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Great. Thanks.
Mr. Bell, it's very apparent to me that state laws and ethics rules for contracting procedures have been weakened or largely ignored for the past 10 years. I'd like to know how you feel this affects services to folks who will need assistance at some time in their life, and I'll just back off and let you answer.
Well, wait, if you would. What specifically are you talking about? What kind of contracting rules are you talking about?
Well, I'm talking about contracts for services, particularly for example, back when we had a Department of Mental Health and Mental Retardation before it was largely destroyed. I'm talking about services to dislocated workers, and I'd just like to hear how you answer that.
Well, I talk about the ethics rules a lot. This particular subject, as far as has not come up specifically. The overall ethical climate in our state government, if you'll allow me to speak to that, is shameful in my way of thinking. We've created a cash and carry government here in the state of Texas, whereby if you can write big checks to political candidates and if you can hire the big time lobbyists, your concerns will be dealt with. And Austin, you'll be the one who will be considered for contracts. It's all part of a pay to play culture that we've created. And we desperately need measures in place, beginning with campaign finance reform, to deal with what's going on. There's no reason that people should be able to contribute unlimited amounts to folks running for state offices. There are limits in most municipalities and in the federal government, and that works just fine, and you're certainly able to raise enough money and get your message out. And so those types of measures are very much needed, and the overall ethical quality of our state government needs to be looked at very closely. And people can check that out online, too. It's chrisbell.com, and we have a Don't Mess With Ethics plan that has about 8 points to try to deal with this whole pay-to-play culture.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next up, we have Kenneth calling from Fort Worth. Hi, Kenneth.
Hey, how you doing?
Great, thanks.
Yeah, my question is, I am normally a party-line Democratic voter, and I haven't voted for a Republican since Reagan. I voted for Reagan the first time. And my question is, why should I vote for a Democrat now who's going to act like a Republican once he get elected? I am seriously considering voting for Kinky Freeman. Strayhorn is just not even an option.
Well, let's see if we can get an answer. Do you plan to act like a Republican once you get elected?
No, and I think that's very clear from the approach I've taken to this campaign. And, you know, Kinky Freeman's funny, but just like we've seen, we don't need a joke for a governor. We don't need a governor just for jokes. And I think it's serious business. The problems facing our state are very serious, and I think people of Texas deserve a serious governor. And I don't have any plans to – I've put out on the table, you know, my major priorities in dealing with public schools, looking to get more money into public school education, getting serious about improving access to health care and health care insurance, and trying to address the cuts that were made to the Children's Health Insurance Program, getting money back into our state park system, cleaning up our environment. I think I've taken a very common sense approach to the challenges that face Texas. And a very serious approach, and something that's needed right now.
What do you think Kinky Freedman's presence on the ballot adds to or takes away from this race? There are lots of voters who say they're considering him seriously.
Well, not as many as you all probably think the media, because I know there's a great deal.
Well,
he
got a lot of signatures. He's got some money.
He did, and it's somewhat entertaining, and. I think when it started out, a lot of people thought there, because of something that you brought up earlier, Chris, the fact that no Democrat has won in 12 years, and people are saying, oh, a Democrat can't win in Texas, so this would be a great year. Let's just, you know, elect the school mascot homecoming queen. Let's cast a protest vote in this election. Well, now a lot of people are doing the math and recognizing this is probably the best chance for the Democrats to take back the governor's office since Ann Richards was on the ballot back in 1990. Because of the strange dynamic, that works to our benefit. What's very likely to happen is that Kinky Freeman's percentage of the vote will remain quite low, and Carol Strayhorn and Rick Perry will end up dividing the Republican vote. She's been spending a lot of time trying to trick Democrats into believing that she's something that she isn't. She's been a part of the Republican Party for the last 21 years and usually has shared the same positions as Rick Perry. And so the bottom line is that if the Democratic Party stays united, we're going to have a new Democratic governor in January 2007, and it's just simply foolish for people to throw their vote away.
Regardless of who wins, whoever takes this office is unlikely to do so with a majority of the votes.
Right.
As an elected official, could you see your way clear to supporting something and working for something that you personally really disagreed with, but you were convinced that the majority of Texans wanted to see happen?
Well, what I can see my way very clearly toward is working with the other party. And that's what used to happen in Texas. And most governors who've succeeded in the Lone Star State have done so by being willing to sit down with the other side and identifying what was in the best interest of our state. And
that's happened under Governor Bush, a lot of people think.
Well, remember, he ran as united, not a divider. And then he went to Washington and realized how that place works. And I was there for only a short while, but I was there long enough to see how it works, or more accurately, how it doesn't work. It's all about partisanship. And the fact that Rick Perry would try to use that model and implement it here in the state of Texas is absolutely unforgivable, because that's never how we've gotten ahead. And whether you're talking about public school education or health insurance or any of these other challenges that we face, there's not going to be a Democratic solution, nor is there going to be a Republican solution. There will be Texas solutions for a lot of these problems, but that requires sitting down at the table. And it would be absolutely absurd for me to go as a Democrat to quite likely be still working with a Republican legislature and to think that I could take some type of my way or the highway approach. I could sit over there and scream for 4 years, but that's never been what I've been about during my career in public service, and it's not what I'm going to focus on as governor. I'm going to focus on results.
Next on the line, we have Hoyt in Arlington. Hi, Hoyt.
yes, Chris. I belong to an organization called Healthcare for All of Texas, and we're trying to bring universal health care to Texas. We know that if we take the money that we're all spending on health care at the present time, we can set up an insurance company and insure everyone in the state for the same amount of money that we're spending now. What is your position on universal health care?
Well, for the sake of full disclosure, Hoyt also... I've also seen the plan that he's put together, and he's done a tremendous amount of work. You are the individual who's done that, correct?
We don't have him on the line
okay.
any longer.
And I think he's the same individual, because there are not that many Hoyts out there probably who have focused as much attention on health care, and he's done a great job in putting together a plan, and we've looked at it and we're studying it. And yes, I want to see a plan. I want to look at what Massachusetts has done and what California has done and trying to develop affordable pools of insurance to get as many individuals here as possible back in the ranks of the insured. We can't just sit back and twiddle our thumbs, because the federal government has shown no inclination whatsoever to deal with this health care crisis. Other states are stepping up and addressing the problem and trying to find innovative solutions. And now we have the benefit of seeing where they've succeeded and where they have failed, what's working, what's not. And at a time when our state desperately needs leadership in an area when it comes to health care insurance, Rick Perry can't even manage to follow. And that's unforgivable. And at the very least, we must find a way to restore the cuts that were previously made to the Children's Health Insurance Program. There's no reason that one of the richest states in the entire country cannot find a way for all kids to be insured.
You have been vehemently opposed to the Trans-Texas Corridor. What's your concern?
My concern is that the eminent domain process is being misused. The eminent domain process is never going to win a governmental entity any friends, or a lot of friends, even when it's being used correctly. But in this particular case, it's being used primarily to benefit a private contractor, or a private contractor that is a European consortium, Centra, that has some Texas partners, but primarily is a European company. And I think that when you heap the distrust on top of the eminent domain process, the fact that one of Rick Perry's cronies was representing the European company and then cycled back onto the governor's staff after the contract was secured as his legislative director, the fact that it's turned into a giant land grab, basically benefiting this one private entity, I think the distrust of the people is warranted. And I've talked to friends in the legislature who feel that they were somewhat misled about what the project would be about. If you remember, when the Trans-Texas Corridor was first put on the table, it looked like this very modern, futuristic approach to our transportation needs. And now to see that it's become a giant toll road and a giant land grab is simply unacceptable. And I think it should be brought back to the legislature where it can be considered in a much more enlightened environment.
So you do think the state needs to look at alternatives for infrastructure
growth? Well, always.
Growth.
Mm-hmm. Always. We need roads. And in some cases, you know, there have been instances where toll roads have worked. The Dallas-Fort Worth Turnpike is a good example. The toll roads were up there when I was growing up. They're gone now, and you have a freeway. And so, and there are instances and or examples in Harris County where they've been successful. And so, but this idea that Rick Perry has that you can just make every road a toll road and somehow have transportation now be between the haves and the have-nots, those who can pay the tolls and those who can't, that's just not the right way to go. And I think it's time that we have a really serious public policy debate here in the state of Texas about whether we want to forfeit our destiny when it comes to transportation to a bunch of European companies and consortiums that seem to be the only ones who are in a position to compete for those projects right now.
If we go very quickly, we have time for one more call. That's John in Coppell. Hi, John.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thanks.
My question is, I'm looking at the most recent polling, and I know we don't like to look at polls, but I'm disturbed by the fact that 60-something percent of Texans work for somebody other than Rick Perry. And so I was listening to your discussion a minute ago about that, but what's the plan for getting the anti-Perry people who are in Kinky's camp, the anti-Perry people who Rylander's camp, and your, what's the plan to get them all together? Because I agree, this is our best shot to get him out, and I would prefer to get you into the governor's mansion.
Coming on shows like Chris's and telling people about the opportunity, because you're right. And what usually ends up happening, I mean, this has been a battle to see who can go to second place. And obviously, Carol Strayhorn started out with a great deal more name identification. She's been in public office for 12 years. But amazingly, even in the early going, we were staying even with her, and now have gone ahead. And I think when people start actually doing the math and recognizing the fact that you have to have that Democratic base in order to be competitive, we're going to be in a great position to win. And you will see the votes starting to consolidate. People realize it's no longer really funny to be casting a protest vote for Kinky Friedman. They'll realize that Carol Strayhorn is in no way, shape, or form a Democrat, even though she's flip-flopped on a million different issues. And I think you'll start seeing people come home or stay home in the Democratic column. And I'm looking forward to that.
Being governor is a demanding job. Running for governor is a demanding job. You've got two young boys at home. How well do they understand the sacrifices that your family's making right now for you to seek this position?
Well, a lot better. And actually, running for governor is a lot easier than serving in Congress, because I don't have to travel 1,000 miles out of town every week and then just come home for a few days and have a brutal schedule then as well. But they're at an age now where they're excited, and it's kind of great in that I got sworn into city council a week before my oldest son's first birthday. And so this is politics and public service has been part of all of their lives. And now they're at an age, they're 8 and 10, both boys, and where they understand it a little bit better. And I think they're really excited about the prospect.
Chris Bell is running for governor of Texas as a Democrat. He is the first of the candidates for governor this year to accept our invitation to be interviewed on this show and respond to your questions. Chris, thanks very much for coming in today.
Chris, thanks so much for the opportunity. It was great.
Chris Bell will be back in North Texas Tuesday, August 29th at 7 to give a speech at Poor David's Pub. His website is chrisbell.com. Jeff Whittington produces the talk show. GD Mascoro is our engineer. Becky Madole screened phone calls today and helped with research. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.